This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. The convoluted punctuation and phrasing of the Second Amendment has allowed it to be open to interpretation, especially in recent years. In 2008, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in the case of the District of Columbia v. Heller that the amendment means that an individual has the right to own a gun for self-defense in the home. That was a groundbreaking decision. Our guest Michael Waldman, author of The Second Amendment, a biography, says that was not what was meant when the Second Amendment was written and passed by Congress in the 18th century. After that time, the amendment was mostly ignored until the middle of the 20th century when gun control and the NRA took up the fight. Today on Radio Times, the Second Amendment from the 18th century to the 21st. Michael Waldman here with us in our Philadelphia studio. He's the president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. And Michael Waldman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Every time we do a show about the Second Amendment, I always have to read the Second Amendment just to remind myself and our listeners what it is we're talking about. So let me do that. It says, a well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed. Is that an awkwardly written amendment from your perspective as a lawyer?
Well, the framers believed in freedom to punctuate.
We know that. Apparently.
It is an awkwardly written sentence. It has different parts. They seem to point in different directions. And we've been wrestling with what it means, arguing about what it means, especially recently, especially intently, as we debate the issue of gun rights.
So going back to when it was offered, James Madison, in many ways, his fingerprints all over this, what was his intention when he conjured the Second Amendment?
Well, that was the very first question I wanted to ask in researching and learning what was behind this. Because, of course, in that Heller decision in 2008, which was the first time the Supreme Court ruled the Second Amendment recognized that kind of individual right, Justice Antonin Scalia said, well, this is the vindication of my approach of originalism. We're going to look back at the original intent of the framers. Well, to understand that intent, you have to understand the world in which they lived, and they cared very passionately about the militias,
right.
The well-regulated militia, which we kind of wonder what that is and maybe skip over it. That was not only the military and police force of the colonies. It was a way people saw as warding off tyranny, and those militias were not like anything we have now. Every adult man, eventually every adult white man was in the militia for their entire life.
16 to 60, right?
16 to 60, except for Pennsylvania, which, because of the powerful Quaker population, it was a bit more confused there. But the rest of the colonies, 16 to 60, and they were required to own a gun and keep it at home and bring that military weapon in for their militia service. They thought this was to ward off the specter of what they called a standing army, which was what King George had, professional soldiers who could break people's liberties. And so when people ask, well, so what does that Second Amendment mean? Does it reflect individual rights? Were they thinking about individual rights, or were they thinking about the militia? The answer is kind of both and neither. They were talking about an individual right to fulfill the duty to serve in the militia. It's very hard for us to even place our minds in that world.
And did they think of the potential tyranny then of a standing army and the federal government of the United States? Was that, you know, after liberation, that was the feared tyranny?
They were worried that tyranny could come back. And you're right in terms of thinking about it as a sort of a post-revolutionary period. And we're having this discussion, of course, just a few blocks from where a lot of this all was first discussed. When the revolution began, those Minutemen at Lexington and Concord, those were citizen soldiers. They brought their weapons from home. That was the apogee of the militias. But the revolution, as it rolled forward, the fact is people like George Washington realized they needed an army, that the militias didn't actually work out that well. And so after the war, when the country began really to fall apart, you had specter of armed violence like Shays' Rebellion, and they gathered here in what eventually became the Constitutional Convention, and the purpose of that Constitutional Convention was to thrust toward a much stronger central government. When the Constitution was released, as you know, there was a roaring, raucous debate about that very fact. One of the things that people were worried about was that there could be this kind of army. And they saw, and those who backed the Constitution argued that these citizen soldier militias were the way, the check against that kind of tyranny.
In fact, you say, going back to the drafting of the Second Amendment, there was very little debate about this. Yes, there were the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, but nonetheless, this didn't have the kind of debate that it seems to have today.
It didn't have the intensity of the debate. It didn't have the volume. And emphatically, you have to really, really look hard to find a debate about what we would call modern gun rights.
Wow.
Individual rights to protect myself, to carry a gun around. They were debating the militias and this issue of military power. And in fact, if you look at James Madison's notes from the Constitutional Convention, if you look at the records of the ratification conventions, with some scattered exceptions, if you look at the debate in the Congress as they wrote and drafted the Second Amendment, it's all talking about militias. Interestingly, I mean, James Madison's original proposal actually called for a conscientious objector provision, saying if you had religious scruples about bearing arms, well, that's okay, you didn't have to do your military service in person. I think they would be very startled to learn what we're talking about nowadays. It's important to remember, they had guns.
I was going to say, didn't almost everyone have a gun back then?
Well, that's open to debate how widespread gun ownership was, but certainly on farms, out on the frontier, there was a lot of gun ownership. And there were gun laws for gun safety. You couldn't store gunpowder in cities. You couldn't fire your gun in the city of Boston. Lots of different categories of people who didn't have a loyalty oath or something like that, they were prohibited from owning guns. So back then, too, there were guns. There were gun laws. And that kind of came down from common law. You had the right to protect yourself from England. But that isn't necessarily what they thought they were writing into the Constitution.
Mm. So from your perspective, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Your reading of what was intended then, you know, more than 200 years ago, was that this was about arming a militia.
It was about an armed citizenry through their militias as a check against potential tyranny. So it's not quite the same as the National Guard, which is our modern version, but that's basically like controlled by the federal government, and not everybody's in it. It was a different worldview. It was, in some ways, it was a level of governmental compulsion that would be very unnerving to lots of people, that you were required to own a gun. You may remember during the Supreme Court argument over the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, the example that was pulled out of when did the federal government previously ever order people to buy something in private commerce, the Militia Act signed by George Washington under the Second Amendment and the militia provisions of the Constitution, that was what they pointed to, although it was a different part of the Constitution. But then something funny happened, because my view is not that we should be guided solely or overtly or overly by trying to go
or
back
concretely,
and, or
maybe.
Concretely, to go back in a time machine, tap James Madison on the shoulder, and say, what did you mean exactly? That's not the best way. That is not the way we have generally made constitutional law over the two centuries of the country. Original meaning and intent is very important when you can figure it out, and the words are obviously very important, but how the country has developed, how it has evolved, is just as important, in fact, is how judges and justices have done it for most of the country's history. And that's part of what's funny is as soon as they passed the Second Amendment, the militias began to evaporate.
Well, and even going back to, as you mentioned, Heller, the Heller decision, and Scalia writing the decision saying, you know, this is what the framers intended. Did he then misread what the framers intended?
I think he did. But I do think he did. And there were one of the dissents in the case, written by Justice Stevens, goes through the history in great detail, just as Justice Scalia felt that he was going through the history and made, I thought, a better historical case, because what Justice Scalia did was he skipped over the role of the militias. Out of the 64 pages of the majority opinion, two deal with the militias, and the rest deal with that phrase, the right to keep and bear arms. And now Justice Scalia fashions himself a textualist in the way he looks at it. He really cares a lot about what the individual words mean. Right. He was looking at dictionaries from the 1800s. To me, it looked like a Scrabble player, you know, trying really hard to prove that
right.
that
triple score points,
word,
right?
you know, really exists. And the words were out of order. The fact is, at the moment, the phrase bare arms had an overwhelmingly military meaning, just mm-hmm. as one example. So I do think he got the history wrong, but I also don't think that that history is the only way we ought to be making a decision like this.
Well, your book is also about a history of the National Rifle Association, the NRA, which came out of the Civil War. In fact, it was members of the Union Army. They were so disturbed by the fact that people were such, I guess, what, bad shots?
Yes.
They wanted to bring some professionalism to gun ownership.
Well, the NRA plays a central constitutional role in this history because, like many other groups throughout the country's long history, they waged a multi-decade campaign for legal change, to change the way we read this part of the Constitution. They're hardly alone in doing that. You know, because as I say, in the 1800s, 1900s, there were guns and there were gun laws. And you had even in the Wild West, in Dodge City, there was
you have to leave your gun outside
right,
or something?
It looks like a movie set, you know, dusty Main Street with a sign in the middle that says, welcome to Dodge City, firearms prohibited. Well, the NRA goes back pretty far, too. Originally, it bills itself on its website as the country's oldest civil rights organization, but that isn't really how it started. It was former officers from the Union Army that were disturbed that the soldiers were poor shots. Before the Civil War, before they had factories to make guns, guns didn't aim very well, so it didn't really matter if you were a good shot or not, but now it started to. So they were about training, they were about marksmanship, about military preparedness, and then over time, they really began to speak for hunters, for the interests of sportsmen, and that's how we think of them throughout, you know, the 20th century mostly. And they were not wild about gun control laws, but they didn't oppose them that strongly, and they supported the 1930s, the first federal gun law proposed by Franklin Roosevelt. The NRA testified for it and was asked, gee, is there any constitutional provision you can think of that might cause a problem here? And they said, we haven't ever given that any thought.
And we're talking, and we're almost up in a break here. This is 1939, the National Firearms Act, where the Supreme Court limited machine guns and sawed-off shotguns, and the NRA
they were fine
on
with
board.
That. And they said, and the Supreme Court said, well, the Second Amendment is talking about guns for the militia. That changed when the NRA changed in 1977.
Hold on to, I didn't mean to cut you off quite that quickly. Hold on to that thought, Michael Waldman. We have to take a very short break. We're talking about the Second Amendment. Our guest has written a biography of the Second Amendment, the book called The Second Amendment, and he is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. What do you think the Second Amendment says? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Pennsylvania Ballet supports WHYY and caps off its golden anniversary with a 50th finale, the ultimate celebration June 12th through the 15th, presented by Bank of America. The program features William Forsythe's Tour de Force in the Middle, Somewhat Elevated, Jerome Robbins' Romantic in the Night, set to Chopin, and two works from Matthew Neenan, Penumbria and La Chasse Duet. Pennsylvania Ballet in a 50th finale, the ultimate celebration June 12th through the 15th at the Merriam Theater. Tickets at paballet.org or 215-893-1999.
These days, it's a 24-hour news cycle.
Information is everywhere.
But is it the right information? I'm Steve Inske.
And I'm Jennifer Lynn. You rely on WHYY and NPR to start your day with not just the headlines, but the in-depth details.
Reporters at WHYY and NPR News are covering stories down the block and around the world.
It's radio so vibrant, you can almost see it.
So you're better informed and ready to take on the day.
Morning Edition, weekday mornings on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Another reason we love our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, how she feels about lettuce.
Seeing tender young greens come up in my garden, I'm like a little kid in a candy store. I am just so excited.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Every time there's a shooting or even a new court ruling, the Second Amendment gets re-argued. Our guest, Michael Waldman, has written a biography of the Second Amendment, looking at it at its original intent and how it has been interpreted and reinterpreted over the years and certainly in recent years. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. We were talking about the NRA before the break, and it began as an organization for hunters and to help people be better marksmen and I guess have responsible gun owners.
Right. And what happened was, in 1977, there was what was called the Revolt at Cincinnati, which was the annual meeting of the NRA, where the NRA had announced that it was going to move its headquarters out of Washington to Colorado to signal a retreat from politics. Hard to believe.
Yeah.
And 1,000 members showed up at the annual meeting and voted out the previous leadership and backed new leadership that was much more intense, much more dogmatic, and emphatically focused on refashioning the organization as a crusade around gun rights. And that marked it. You know, it happened all across the country. There was a backlash against the liberalism of the 60s. There was crime, and people were worried about crime.
A lot of crime.
And it was happening in other kinds of organizations, the churches and the farm groups. And the NRA sort of lurched to the right at a moment when that was happening in a lot of places. And then they waged a multi-decade kind of classic legal campaign, starting with scholarship, moving public opinion so that it is now the mainstream accepted view, moving the organs of government, switching the position of the Justice Department, and only later going to court. So that by the time that case went to the Supreme Court in 2008, it sort of fell like a ripe apple from the tree. It wasn't all that controversial.
Well, let me go back to some of the sort of early changes. I mean, would you say this quote-unquote revolt at Cincinnati, was that a coup at the NRA, or was it just people coming into positions of authority that had certain beliefs about guns and about the government?
I don't know if it wasn't necessary. I don't think it was an illegitimate coup. It was the kind of rank and file of the organization rising up, and a lot of them actually came from other groups like the Second Amendment Foundation and came in and sort of pushed out the old guard. And now when you go to the NRA headquarters in Virginia, it doesn't have, as it used to have, these big letters about marksmanship. You walk into the lobby, there in the pride of place on the wall in big letters is the Second Amendment. But only the part about the right to keep and bear arms. They've actually edited out the rest of it.
Mm-hmm. So, and I have to say, listening to Wayne LaPierre, one gets the sense that the NRA is working for the gun industry. And I say that because it seems that he trades in fears. He says things about the Obama administration, which are absolutely not true. He has not tried to take away people's guns. And we know that people have flocked to gun stores in order to buy guns and ammo for fear that the government is going to take away the guns.
Well, when you hear the NRA convention, when you hear Wayne LaPierre's response to Hurricane Sandy, where he announced that looters were running wild in the streets of Brooklyn. I live in Brooklyn, and it was actually the safest period on record because there was so little crime. When you hear the insurrectionist language, you kind of it really takes one aback, because there is this sense that the government is the enemy, that the only way any of us can deal with the anarchy in which we live is to walk around armed at all times, just doesn't comport with the reality that most of us at least live in. And so it goes beyond the kind of traditional divide between rural Americans who've grown up with guns and hunting, and maybe people who live in cities who have a different view. The language now, at least, seems to be much more intense than that. But I don't know that that's because of the gun industry. I think the gun industry, as we understand, and I know this only from journalism I've read, they've begun funding the NRA, but only in relatively recently.
But it is true that, and we have these horrible, mass shootings as we had in California recently. In the city of Philadelphia, there is gun violence. At the same time, it's a different kind of violence than we had in the 1960s. You and I were talking about this during the break, about just we remember how violent the 1960s were.
Well, the 1960s, you had, the political violence, you had riots, you had assassinations, and you had street crime. And, of course, that continued into the 70s and 80s. And it is hard for people to remember just how prevalent that fear of crime was, and that's in some ways how we have the drug laws that we have that have had something of a really harmful impact well beyond whatever good they might have done in terms of the 2.5 million Americans who are in prison now. That, too, was part of the culture war, the cultural miasma in which the NRA took up this approach. But, you know, interestingly, gun crime, although we obviously have problems in Philadelphia and other cities, gun crime is actually down considerably from where it was nationwide. And as part of that larger crime drop, and there are interesting trends. There are more guns in America than ever before. There's close to 300 million guns.
Wow. And how many people in this country?
Well, about 350 million,
okay.
Right?
So almost one per person.
Yeah. But the ranks of gun owners has shrunk. Fewer people own those more guns. And so it's not clear that it's all for personal protection. But it also suggests that maybe these issues over time will work themselves out. I worry that Second Amendment fundamentalism, and if courts are too aggressive in stepping in, will make it harder to make the compromises, the legislative compromises, fight this out at the ballot box and the court of public opinion. That's where we fought it out for 200 years, and I think it's a better place to do it.
But couldn't it also be argued that even this amendment and other amendments have been reinterpreted over time? I mean, what was true in the 18th century is certainly not true in the 21st century, and that things get reinterpreted based on the realities of today.
Absolutely. And I think that that's the best argument for the Heller case. Not that it was original intent, but that it actually reflected a kind of living constitutionalism. Mm-hmm. The way that the country evolved is you have a wide sense of gun rights and a sense of legitimate gun laws, and that they've gone hand in hand, and that gun laws and gun safety laws and limitations on where you can carry a gun or other things like that don't trample on someone's sacred constitutional rights from the founding fathers, but are actually how it evolved over time. And interestingly, so the Supreme Court ruled in 2008.
This is the Heller case.
In the Heller case. And then 2 years later, they issued a big ruling applying that to the states. And then after that, there have been dozens and dozens of court cases all over the country where federal judges have tried to apply the new rules, the new doctrine, to gun laws. And overwhelmingly, those laws have been upheld. They've said, you know what? Yes, there's a right, an individual right. We don't quite know how broad it is, but there's also a public right for safety. And even the Heller case said the same thing when you kind of stopped looking at the finery of the historical stuff. It said there's an individual right, but there can be limits. Didn't really spell out what all those limits were. But there's something of a judicial consensus that we've seen develop that could reflect both gun rights and gun safety.
But just picking up on the Heller case, and even to you personally, then, from your perspective, the idea that the Second Amendment means an individual has a right to own a gun for self-defense in the home, does that seem like a fair interpretation of the Second Amendment? You just made a face.
I think that it's pretty common and it's pretty widespread, and I don't have a problem with somebody being able to do that. But I do think the place to have addressed it was in the legislature and at the ballot box. I have not noticed a huge amount of success in passing confiscatory gun laws at any point in the last half century, and I just get worried when sort of rights without responsibilities are interpreted into the Constitution. You know, the idea of judicial restraint, for a long time, actually, it was kind of a liberal idea. Then in the Warren Court era in the 60s and 70s, conservatives talked endlessly about judicial restraint. Now it tends to be liberals again who've rediscovered the virtues in it. It all, you know, as they say, it gives hypocrisy a bad name. But actually, the reality is, we as a country are better off when these kinds of complex issues, if possible, can be hashed out by the push and pull of public debate and political action. But of course, that is in part how you get Supreme Court rulings too.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Michael Waldman. Again, he's the president of the Brennan Center for Justice. That's at NYU School of Law. And he's also the author of a new book. It's called The Second Amendment, a Biography. And it's essentially a history of the Second Amendment, taking us from the 18th century to today. And again, we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. What do you think of the Second Amendment? I know you began to write this book after the Newtown Massacre, when Adam Lanza killed all those school children in Newtown, Connecticut. And speaking of politics, there was a great cry, you know, to bring about some kind of gun registration. There was a lot of support, or I guess it was background checks, actually.
Yeah,
a lot of support.
It wasn't registration.
Background checks. And you know, I think it was like 90% support. Even members of the NRA were in support of this. It goes to Congress, and it dies. It doesn't
right.
get passed.
And in fact, the NRA previously had been supportive of background checks that in the 1990s. There was up to 90% public support. Nobody really thought that kind of background check, expanded background check, violated the Second Amendment, mm-hmm. because all it was doing was making sure that people who shouldn't have guns, in fact, couldn't get the guns. I would say that the level of intensity in opposition, as ever on this issue, the intensity so far has been with the NRA and with gun rights supporters. It was rather early. It's hard to build a movement that quickly. It's also the case that a majority of the Senate voted for this bipartisan Manchin-Toomey bill. And you might say that it was the filibuster rules of the Senate that prevented action more than public opinion, the Constitution, or even the NRA.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And so, you know, it's very hard to get anything passed in Congress these days, and this was no exception. But I do think that it's the first time we've had this kind of debate on new gun safety laws in about 20 years, and it's the first time since the Supreme Court articulated this new version, anyway, of what the Second Amendment means. Some people say, well, that actually should make it easier because there's not a legitimate fear that black helicopters are going to come and take away all your guns if you're a legitimate gun owner.
You hear that from some extremists.
But, the Supreme Court wouldn't let it happen. And those fears, however legitimate they are, they're really not going to happen. So maybe this draws a line, but it hasn't worked out that way yet anyway.
Indeed. But do you think there is, it sounds like you think or maybe hope that we're moving towards some middle ground where people can legitimately own a gun, but there can be things like background checks and registrations and some way of finding something for both sides to feel good about?
I would think so. We've had a reason, a kind of common sense Second Amendment, a reasonable Second Amendment, as some called it, where there were gun ownership for hunting or for self-protection, but not unlimited gun ownership, and there could be safety rules and public safety rules, especially in places where there's danger, like carrying a gun around in a city. I was struck recently by a statistic I heard about a week ago, which is both encouraging and horrifying. In the United States this year, more people will be killed by a gun than by a car.
Wow.
Something like 33,000 people. And that is a first. Now, at one level, that's horrifying. That's a lot of people killed by guns. Of course, a lot of that is suicide.
And, right.
But that's a lot. But actually, part of the story there is cars used to kill a lot more people, and they made them safer. They didn't confiscate the cars. They didn't ban cars. They didn't come in and take away your right to drive. They raised the drinking age. Seatbelts, airbags. Older people have to get eye tests. So things like that technological fixes that actually made cars safer. There are similar kinds of things, similar kinds of interventions that turn out to make guns safer or less prone to be in the wrong hands. And if this Second Amendment fundamentalism doesn't get in the way, that could really point a way forward for the country.
That sounds so reasonable, but we're talking about, there is no amendment that says you have the right to drive a car, right? Isn't that part of the difference?
That's right, although, in fact, this is one of those, as they call them, unenumerated rights. If the federal government passed a law saying you do not have the right to drive between states or to travel on the roads, then in fact, I bet the Supreme Court would find a way to strike that down. And, in a sense, that was what they were truly thinking about back in the founding days, because they thought people had guns, but they thought that they were also went along with gun laws. That's why the focus on the wording of the Second Amendment takes on a greater significance than it might otherwise.
We've done a number of shows about guns and NRA and about gun violence as well and crime. And we've had pretty consistently people who say, look, I'm a member of the NRA, but I support gun control. I support some degree of registration. I believe I have the right to own my guns, and I'm a responsible person. It seems like that's probably where most people actually are.
I would think so. And most people who have guns, they want them to protect their families or hunt or whatever. They're not affected by very many of the kinds of rules and prohibitions that are being discussed, or things that make guns safer or less likely to be used by children or those other kinds of things. Again, a lot of people would welcome them.
It seems now the focus is more on things like mental health issues, whether, there's some way to, I don't know, even know how this would work, but to get some kind of stamp of approval, I guess, before buying a gun, that one is sane or mentally stable. I don't even know how that would work exactly, but I'd be curious what you think.
Well, of course, after Newtown and after this recent horrific shooting in California, people did focus, understandably, on the mental state of the assailant and on the mental health system, and it's complicated. Yeah. This complicates it because, especially if something is deemed to be a right, very few people are involuntarily committed to psychiatric care in this country. And
you have to be a danger to yourself and others, right?
And even the guy out in California, people were worried enough that he was a danger that his parents sent the police, but they didn't, that fact alone would not have been enough to prevent him from purchasing guns legally. And so, perhaps, and some people are exploring this, are there sort of intermediate steps that when somebody is a danger to themselves, and that's really where the danger tends to be more often, or to others, maybe there's something there. But this it's important when people say, oh, well, the issue is not guns, it's mental health. Of course, we need a strong mental health system in the United States, an improved mental health system. But one of the improvements has to be to make sure that people who have issues aren't able to hurt other people unduly.
And that's Michael Waldman, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's a biography called The Second Amendment, a biography. And he is the president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from the new Wells Fargo Propel World American Express card, designed to bring the world within reach for Wells Fargo customers. Details at a local Philadelphia area branch or wellsfargo.com/propel. Wells Fargo, the world is open. Keep exploring.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Nell Bernstein shares stories of kids locked up in America's juvenile detention facilities.
His whole dorm was stripped to their boxers, handcuffed, chained together, taken to the gymnasium, and forced to kneel there for 2 weeks.
Bernstein's book is Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The Bergdahl questions and the soldiers who are asking them.
Guys say, this didn't have to happen. Why did you do this? But I've spent enough time having to worry about Bergdahl. I'm glad he's back, and I just want the truth to be out there.
When an alleged deserter becomes a hostage and soldiers die trying to rescue him, what are the rules of engagement? Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Bad energy habits around the office can affect your bottom line. PICO Smart Ideas for Your Business can help with customized tips, information, and programs designed to save you energy and money. Learn more at PICO.com/smartideas. PICO supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. And just to recap, there was very little debate back in the late 18th century when James Madison introduced and Congress passed the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Today, it is the most divisive of all the amendments, and it certainly gets re-argued every time there's a new shooting or there's a new court ruling. This is what our guest Michael Waldman writes about in his new book called The Second Amendment, A Biography. Our phones have exploded at 1-888-477-9499. And before we get to our callers, something you say at the end of the book, which it sounds like what you're saying to the gun control people, is perhaps there's some lessons that can be learned from what the NRA has been able to do from their side, I guess, of the argument.
Absolutely. And in fact, I attended a recent session at the Open Society Foundations, which is a sort of a liberal foundation in New York, where the former president of the NRA talked about how, alongside the leader of the Freedom to Marry group, which of course has also waged a very successful legal campaign, what the NRA did, like it or not, was in the great American tradition of understanding that the way you move the Supreme Court is by moving the public, by moving public opinion. Well, Abraham Lincoln said at a time of constitutional conflict about slavery, he said, with public opinion, anything is possible. Without it, nothing is possible. It's more important than being a judge or a legislator, is what he said. And the NRA took that seriously. They backed scholarship. I had problems with a lot of the scholarship, but it was a pretty serious effort. And other groups have waged similar campaigns. Marriage equality, the folks who brought the cases that eventually led to Citizens United and other recent Supreme Court rulings striking down campaign finance laws. So for people who care about gun safety, who would deem themselves to care that way and are on the other side, they have no choice but to wage a long-term campaign looking at the jurisprudence, looking at scholarship, moving public opinion and organizing, and it doesn't happen overnight, and it took the NRA decades. That's true on all kinds of other issues. We're always debating the Constitution, and ultimately it's always up to the people what the Constitution means. That's true here, too.
Well, but it always, and I do want to get to our callers, but it you know, after there's a horrible shooting, then I think people do get upset, and there's this sense that we have to do something, but then it kind of fades away.
It fades away, and the intensity fades, and and the worry is that these kind of every year or two there'll be a mass shooting somewhere and it'll be the new normal. So I sure hope people don't lose interest in this and do understand that whether it's a good idea or not, whatever the gun laws are, whatever steps actually make a difference, it's important not to be guided by emotionalism, but what would actually work. The way the Second Amendment should be read and the way courts have been reading it is not actually the obstacle to common sense movement forward on this.
Let me get to, looks like John from Bethlehem to join us on Radio Times. Hi, John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Two quick comments. I'm an ardent NPR listener and certainly call myself a progressive, if not liberal, and a longtime gun owner, responsible gun owner. And I just, from my side, you know, when Sarah Brady was pushing the enactment of the Brady Bill, all we kept hearing was be reasonable. All we're asking for is a waiting period, which I thought was reasonable. But I'll tell you, a lot of my friends, when they saw her stand up next to the president and say, this is just the beginning, on the day that the bill was signed, you know, kind of galvanized them, like, well, let's not go down that path. Let's keep the fight, you know, as far forward as we can. So I think that's been kind of an issue in a lack of trust on both sides here. Other comment? You referred to the latest California shooting,
right?
And it wasn't strictly shooting. I mean, there's knives involved.
Exactly.
So, you know, but it's been portrayed in the media as nothing but shooting since the second day the story was reported.
Well, John,
I think it does a disservice to the whole mental health issue. I mean, it's really where the focus should be on that particular issue.
Well, I appreciate the call because I think you raised some really good points. Let me give Michael Waldman a chance to respond.
Well, that is a good point, and others say not only knives, but the car. And the part of the answer was the car was registered, and he had a license on the car. But you're right that there's no set of laws that anybody could come up with that would stop all violence or all mentally ill people or anybody else from committing violence. It is worth noting that California has a strict law dealing with assault weapons, and he did not have assault weapons. He had other kinds of guns, and so it is conceivable that it could have been a much more horrific set of deaths than there even was had the laws been different there. But I think the caller is right, but it is also the case that since what happened with the Brady Bill and the assault weapons ban in the early 1990s is it was one of the factors that led to the Republican takeover of the Congress. And since 1994, and I was Bill Clinton's chief speechwriter back then, I remember it very well, there's been very little momentum for gun control, and the momentum, generally speaking, has been in the other direction, especially in states.
But do you think John is also right that not Sarah Brady necessarily, but others will stand up and say this is just the beginning, that there are people that say they do want to take guns away? They might, I mean, President Obama hasn't said anything like that, but you can find that soundbite somewhere.
I think you'd have to look pretty hard. I don't know of much movement or much effort to kind of confiscate guns on a large scale. I think that there are a variety of things that gun safety groups would want that are not happening now. So in that sense, I suppose anything is just the beginning.
John, thanks for the call. Let me get Steve from Maple Glen, Pennsylvania, to join us. Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Really enjoying your program today.
Thanks. Great.
I had just a comment. Most of my friends that are more conservative are concerned about the government getting information on gun owners and the government taking away guns. What if we got a third party to do the registration? Like, just for argument's sake, someone like Google would approve you or not approve you of owning a gun to a certain set criteria that we could all agree upon, and then those that would have a problem with gun ownership, then the government can go to them and or take their guns, and the vast majority of people that have no problem won't be disturbed. We could find an objective third party, and that might make everybody happy.
Well, I can see arguments all over that one, but I'd be curious what Michael Waldman has to say.
It's an interesting idea. The one thing I don't think it would do is make everybody happy.
No, I don't think so.
But I think it's an interesting idea, and we face a lot of these questions for that. That is like an idea that has been raised, for example, when it comes to the bulk collection of metadata by the National Security Agency from phone companies and Google and other companies. And some people have said, well, if you don't feel comfortable with the government having all this information, what about a third party?
Right.
And it's stored out there. And then if you need to get the information, you go with a search warrant. On something like this, I don't know that would necessarily make people feel better, because I think that what people are expressing is a more broad libertarian concern about, you know, get the government off my back and in a sense, a kind of autonomy and privacy. And I don't know that it would actually solve the political concern. And I can imagine other concerns that might be raised about giving that information to a private company.
Steve, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And that kind of takes us back to the Second Amendment, when there was some suspicion of a federal government, right?
Yeah, the
militias were a defense against the tyranny of federal government.
Where there was debate about the Second Amendment was around, not about the amendment so much, but around this fear of a standing army, which was seen as the way kings threatened liberty. And they saw these 13 state militias as a check against that. And there's even a provision in the Constitution, which we kind of skip over, of the Maine Constitution, that goes in great detail, and this is what they debated, into could there be a standing army? How did the militias get controlled? The militias could be called into federal service, but there are all these restrictions, and who could do it? The president can do it. President commands it. Congress makes the call. Who appoints the officers? That was what they were really debating about. And it was out of this long-standing worldview of what they called civic republicanism. It was not just about individual rights. It was sort of about your duty as a citizen to participate, and the way you did it was by bearing arms in your militia. Again, they had guns. They had guns to shoot rabbits. They had guns to protect their homes. They had guns for all different kinds of reasons, and there were gun rules, too. But if you actually go look at what they were debating when they were debating the Constitution, it was the Second Amendment as a way to fight against tyranny.
Huh.
But it wasn't just individual vigilantes. It was through these well-regulated militias.
Let me get Tom from Collegeville to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty and Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, just a quick comment. You know, I'm the father of two young kids, both two under two, so life's pretty hectic. But I guess my concern with the whole gun control movement is the propensity of things to spiral out of control. I'm a resident of Pennsylvania, obviously. I have my concealed carry permit. And I don't go to places looking for trouble, but when I'm out, I feel that I am the sole person who takes responsibility for my family's safety. And, you know, I guess that's my concern is, Mike mentioned, common sense and kind of the sense of common good. I understand that you're never going to be able to regulate bad people from doing bad things. And this 300 million guns that are out there, it's a Pandora's box of sorts. And, I think the only thing that really keeps people who are bad from doing these bad things and letting them get out of control is a good guy with a gun.
Well, and look at
people in California, the marshals who responded, that's the only reason that kid didn't go and carry out the rest of his plan, you know? So
yeah, I
understand there's a need to have common sense, but also I just believe that if you look back over the last 100 years and the large expansion of the government, we're on a pretty slippery slope, and I think that's what folks like me are concerned about. I don't think I should, have a fighter jet or a cannon in my garage or anything like that. But I just think that when you regulate areas where people can go and you restrict them, you really just set, you know, the innocent up for failure, really.
Well,
you
Tom, let me take your call and just give Michael Waldman a chance to respond. And sounded like I heard a little bit of the good guy with a gun and the bad guy with a gun. But that's, you know, that's certainly a strong perspective.
Yeah, and I think the caller articulated it well, and it's certainly the view of millions and millions of people and millions of responsible gun owners who are only interested in protecting themselves or their families. You know, it's also the case that there are risks and greater dangers, as the Supreme Court even and other courts have recognized, in having a society, especially in more urban areas where there's lots of people together, where everybody's carrying a gun and you don't necessarily know who has the gun, and things, violence of other kinds can kind of spiral out of control. And it's not just as a kind of factual matter, it's not clear that that there aren't greater risks from that than we want, obviously, people to be able to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. It's also the case that one big difference now from the frontier, say, or certainly from the colonial period, is we do have police. We do have an army, but we also have police, and we protect ourselves as a society in different ways. One other big difference, and your caller spoke to it, is there's now a very big difference between guns that are extra dangerous and a handgun, you know, that he might be carrying, as he's described. An assault weapon is a military weapon. It's not something you would carry to protect your two-year-old kid. And so that is another distinction. But I think he's articulated that point of view very well.
Indeed. Tom, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me go back to something that you talked about, the kind of scholarship that the NRA has done to present its point of view about guns. But you also talk about some of the misquoting, I would say, of founding fathers. One of the famous quotes is Thomas Jefferson, "One loves to possess arms." Can you put that phrase into a context for us?
Look, a lot of the scholarship was very good, and some of it at least was like what they do when they write movie posters, you know, where they find a quote.
Yeah, it's a great movie, except, right.
Yeah. And that quote from Thomas Jefferson. Now, Jefferson he was actually more gun-focused probably than a lot of the other founding fathers, but he was also out of the country when they did the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. But this is a quote from him. He says, one must love to possess arms, the one hopes to never have to use them. And you see that in law review articles, you see that in scholarly publications as showing what the intent of the Second Amendment was. You can see it on the NRA website. You can go on the internet and buy a T-shirt with it emblazoned on it. But when you actually look at what he said, he was writing a letter to George Washington. He said, you know, you remember I sent you those letters about that decision I made when I was Secretary of State? I think I'm going to get criticized for it. Can I have the letters back? One loves to possess arms, though one hopes never to have to use them. I really need this to defend myself if someone criticizes me for what I did.
So you, as a metaphor.
It was a metaphor. And, but, you know, that's been pointed out, but you can still go on the NRA site and see it there. And you know, there are too many things like that. The famous quote from Patrick Henry, "Let the great object is, let every man be armed." And when Dick Heller, the plaintiff in the Heller case, had his press conference after the ruling, he stood in front of a banner that said that. And there's a very influential book with that title, "Let Every Man Be Armed." But when you go look at the Virginia Ratification Convention, which was the where they were fighting about all this stuff about the Constitution, Patrick Henry, who opposed the Constitution, was saying, wait a minute, James Madison, you're saying that both the federal government and the Virginia government would have the duty to get arms for the militia? Do you know how expensive that is and how wasteful? Why, the great object is let every man be armed, in effect, but only once, you know? So it actually was complaining about government waste. It's when you go back and read these things, it's always surprising and intriguing to see what they were, the different world they were living in. Again, I just think we can't pretend to ourselves in 2014 that we're going to be able to decide what a constitutional provision means or how to govern ourselves simply by going and misremembering history. It's got to be what's good for Americans today.
Well, on that note, Michael Waldman, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's the president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, and his book is called The Second Amendment, a Biography. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. In fact, it's a good place to sign up for our newsletter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, and Emily Bryant, with help today from Sophie Reed. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you for those phone calls, and thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.